Welcome to the second episode of Still Me, Living Positive with HIV. So the main objective of this podcast is to create an open, empowering and stigma-free space for honest dialogue about living positively with HIV. So this is through personal stories, expert insights and lived experiences. The podcast aims to educate, inspire and break down misconceptions amongst university students. It will highlight resilience, health management and self-acceptance while reinforcing the message that an HIV diagnosis does not define a person's worth, dreams, or future. So with me in studio, I do have Amanda Mohlala, who's experienced executive director with over 20 years of leadership in public health, clinical research and health systems strengthening. So proven track record in effectively leading multiple clinical trial research, health system strengthening and laboratory systems strengthening project with focus implementing transformative programs in HIV, TB, reproductive, maternal in South Africa, Mozambique and Zambia. Second guest is Ibanomo Ndengema, who is an HIV activist, storyteller and global advocate for adolescent girls and young women with HIV. Born with HIV, Nomonde has transformed her personal journey into a mission to empower young women and girls living with HIV. She is the author of Heart to Heart, a poignant collection of poems and letters from diverse voices online. This book stands as a testament to her commitment to creating compassionate societies and breaking down stigma and discrimination for people living with HIV. We also do have Sister Ndivu from Seashore right here at the university, as well as Tina Ncham, who is also a student right here at the University of Johannesburg. Yes, let's get into it. South Africa has made remarkable strides in HIV and prevention, yet remains the country with the highest number of people living with HIV. So how do we reconcile this contradiction and what does it reveal of the epidemic today? I think I'll pose this one for you, Amanda. How do we navigate through that?
And thank you so much for that question. I think, firstly, I wouldn't really classify South African history with HIV and story with HIV as a contradiction. It's a mirror, right? It's really a reflection of what will go right in terms of the political will. And also when science come together, we've made great strides when it comes to that. But also a perception of what happens when inequality, when gender-based violence, when poverty is not addressed. We look at it now and understand that it is not only a biomedical challenge anymore, it is a socioeconomic challenge. It is talking about youth empowerment. It is talking about how do we integrate the services that we offer when it comes to us fighting the pandemic and reaching, our targeted 2035 with an AIDS-free world. But again, when I talk about it not being a contradiction, let's look at the achievements as well that we've had. I mean, we have close to 6 million people or more than 6 million people on treatment. We have policies in terms of the management of HIV. We've got great strides and achievement when it comes to the decline in HIV-related mortality and also the vertical transmission rates. We have successful preventative strategies that are talking to, availability of PrEP, HIV self-testing. So in that regard, I also want to then say the contradiction then underscores also this paradigm shift of saying, let's address the equity part of it. Let's address youth empowerment part of it. Let's address the fact that the services that we are currently rendering have to be integrated. If you go into a facility and you're a key population person, what are barriers and challenges that you are facing when you're a youth What are those? Do we have these services then available in terms of setting up the youth clinics? Do we have one-stop shops where the services are integrated, but this differentiated service delivery model where I'm coming in for a mental health, I'm coming in to report my boyfriend who has abused me and I've got a broken collarbone. Am I going as a healthcare worker going to address HIV with you as a young person? So as much as we are saying it's contradictory, what we should be living with is South Africa has the number, the highest number of people living. Can we underline and bold that living word? And I think that's where we are. It's really not a contradiction, but it is a mirror.
All right. So, sister, I think I'll pose this one to you. There's been, with the rollout of the new forms of PrEP, such as long-acting injectable, this is cabotegravir. How can we ensure these prevention tools are reaching populations who need them most, especially young women and key populations in South Africa?
Thank you very much. With our campus health services, right now we are experiencing a problem, especially with US funding. Right now we are experiencing a lot of challenges because previous years we had external stakeholders that were helping us, like Vets Health and ANOVA. They used to come to the clinics, once across all the campuses, at least once in a week, to roll out the PrEP. But since the beginning of this year, we are experiencing a problem and the students are defaulting, especially those that are on PrEP. So they are frustrated because when they come, they are not getting what they are supposed to get. So it means that we are preaching this gospel to say that they need to protect themselves. But whenever they come, they are not getting anything. So we have to refer them to the nearby clinics or the nearby hospitals where they end up being frustrated and just leave it because they're not getting any help because of the long queues, because of the inadequate resources, no mental powers, they are so frustrated. So they end up being defaulted. So it's a challenge. So right now, as I'm speaking, yesterday we had this COJ where we collaborated with. They are coming, they started yesterday, they are coming at APB, and we are still going to collaborate with other clinics like APK across UJ to at least they said they are going to be able to help those that are in need of PrEP. But still, it's an ongoing process because they don't have a capacity to do that because there are some other issues or there are some other services that are giving. So it's a problem. So, but whenever the student is it's ready and wants this service, can come to Campus Health and talk to us so that we can be able to assist.
All right.
And refer appropriately.
Okay. The UNAIDS, is it the triple 95 strategy, aims for 95% of people with HIV to know their status. So 95% of those to be on treatment and 95% of those to be virally suppressed. So in real terms, what progress has South Africa made and what are the barriers to reaching these targets, underserved communities, or targeted underserved communities? I think, Amanda, you're best suited for this one.
I mean, when it comes to the 95 UNAIDS targets, I think we are very close to reaching them, but we're not there yet. There is still quite a number of effort that needs to go in, especially with the second 95. So if you've rightfully indicated that the first 95 talks to people living with HIV actually knowing what their status is. So the current stats in South Africa says we are at 94% of people who are living with HIV knowing their status. The second 95, and this is the target that we are struggling with as a country, is speaking to those that have tested positive. Are they enrolled into care? Do they have access to ARVs? And we are currently now sitting at a rate of about 83% to 84%, I think. And those that are on treatment, and we're doing very well with viral suppression, meaning that because I'm on treatment, my viral load is actually decreased, right? So the third target, the third 95, we have actually are doing very well on that. And that's why I say that we are close, but we're not yet there. I really like to believe that the last mile of the triple 95 really lies, and it's running through the unforgotten rural villages. It's running through the streets of informal settlements, but it's also running through our youth. You know, that's where we are in key populations. That's where we need to get involved. That's where we need to put structures. That's where we need to have community-led and youth-led programs. That's where we need to actually then, and I would like to get Nomonde's, Iban Nomonde, a view on this as to where then, as a youth who is living the experience, who is living so positively with HIV and doing very well, but I'm sure she's got her friends and her peers, and what is it that she would really see the contribution, and from the South African government perspective and other stakeholders, how do we then come in and play a role?
Thank you so much, Samantha. I think I always emphasize on youth-led programs that really respond to our needs as young people living with HIV. Because for so long, we're just accepting and welcoming the systems and programs that have been set for us, with us in mind, not with us in the room. Decisions have been made for us without our contribution as to what we really need. And so there's been that clash in this is what we're creating for young people living with HIV. However, it's not really serving us. And then it would seem as if those systems, the systems are ineffective, but it also seems like the youth are not taking advantage of those systems that are for them. But it's just that they are not meeting our realities. And to change that, when there are systems and programs that are being created, we need young people with experience of living with HIV to be in the room to inform those systems, because you cannot make a program for a person living with HIV and you don't have that experience. It's our experience that kind of builds, or rather, it's our experiences that are the building blocks for the programs. And so part of the work that I do as and health advocates and the Her Voice Fund ambassador is to work with grassroots organizations in South Africa to build programs and events that are well suited to cater to the needs of AGYW living with HIV. So whether they're having trouble with treatment adherence, accepting their status or whatsoever, those are all the things we need to respond to. We need to get to some of the bottom line of why are you not taking your treatment? You're not just not taking your treatment because you don't want to. You know very well that taking your treatment is important. I knew that. I just wasn't doing it because I wasn't okay. So we need to get to the not okay. Why are you not taking your treatment? And then when we have that answer, we now advocate for systems that are going to make this person's reality softer. Another cool example to kind of quote here is in the rural areas, emakhaya. It's not that the young girl doesn't want to be on treatment. It's the lack of privacy at home. It's only mom that knew or mom that knows about my status, mom and grandma. But we are like, what, 15 ekhaya? And when I take my treatment, the other kids are going to see, why are you always taking your pills at 6 o'clock? And then they start shaming you and their parents start shaming you because you know how the dynamics are, you know, in households. And the other thing is now I have to fetch my treatment from the clinic, but I have to walk, what, 6 hours and miss school. And I have to stay for like 5 hours at the clinic to get my treatment while feeling unwelcome
very sad, depressed. I don't want to be here. I want to be at school playing with other kids, but I have to be here. So there are a lot of barriers that make living with HIV sort of impossible, that make adherence very impossible. But it's up to stakeholders, up to policymakers, it's up to our leaders to make sure that systems that are with us in mind are created to respond to our needs so that our lifestyles are, that they improve. We don't just live longer, but we live and we thrive with the virus. Yeah.
All right. Still with you, Ibanomond, I think Tina also grouped you into this one because we're speaking of, you know, transforming the stigma. We often speak about stigma as an abstract term. But with you, Nomonde, who was born with HIV, how does stigma manifest on your day-to-day life? And how do we begin to transform the public narrative about what it means to live with HIV, especially in 2025? Who is responsible to eliminating the stigma? I'll start with you, Ibanomonde, then I'll just have your take on this, Tina, as well.
Everyone is responsible with eliminating stigma because stigma began with people. So in order for stigma to also be killed or overcome, it needs to start and end with people. That's just really how it started. Born with HIV, I've obviously struggled a lot with stigma, internal stigma and external stigma. I think for me, getting over internal stigma was the victory point. Because if you can get over the nasty things you say to yourself, there's nothing another person can say to you that's going to hurt you, you know, because you've said the most cruelest things to yourself. So when I was diagnosed with HIV, I was, what, 7? And then I got into primary. And the most I've heard of HIV at that point is to not tell anyone. Don't tell anyone. And I started having friends, best friend circle, drawing hearts, XOXO, BFF, hashtag, you know. And I feel this day, so now I'm starting to learn about HIV. Not so much from home. Home is more professional. They're going to tell me about the medical part of it and that I will not die. Yeah, because they also were not trained to have conversations about HIV with a 7-year-old. Yeah. So when I get to school, when I start primary, now society teaches me about HIV. So yes, my teacher uses the textbook to teach me, but also the jokes that the students make at the back also teach me about HIV and how it's handled, spoken about, and people living with it are dealt with it. And so I didn't know. We obviously learned about stigma in the textbook. I don't know if they called it stigma. I don't know if they use that word stigma or they just say you can hug and play with a person living with HIV. But this other day, I'm just like, okay, these are my friends. I feel kind of sad and lonely with this secret, and I just want to tell it to someone. So I tell my friends, and little did I know, they also have their own, you know, views on this. Because I'm thinking, we're all kids, man. We all don't know what this is. And we start, so we had a tradition where we would share snacks and drinks. All of a sudden, I'm excluded from that. Not entirely. I'd had my portion lost. So I'd have my share of, you know, snacks lost, my portion of the cold drink lost. And at first, that did not really bother me because I was like, no, man, it means I'm the boss now. Like, I'm the, you know, I've made it. Yeah, I've made it. Until we also had a morning tradition every Monday where we hugged each other. Because you don't know what happened over the weekend, and I just missed you so much, my best friend. Until I also started being excluded from that. So then I started realizing that, okay, there is something going on now, but I just don't know what it is. I couldn't point it to HIV. I really could not, you know. And then this random day, my other friend, who we share the same bus back home, she says to me, listen, remember when you told us about your HIV status? I really need you to come back and tell us that you were joking, because that's why we don't eat with you, hug you. We just, you know, I was just like, oh, okay, that's, I understand what my, yeah, this is what it is. I understand what my mom meant now. And at that moment, I decided to just deny my story because it's not normal for a child to not have friends. So I was like, no, of course I'm joking, right? Where would I get it? And I don't know how the news got to my other friends, but we started hugging and eating together again. And I was just so happy to be there, man. But what that did to me is it kind of amplified, enhanced my internalized stigma, because now I don't even have the opportunity to be vulnerable with my friends anymore. So it means that this thing would always have to be internalized, that I would never have to have authentic relationships and friendships and connections because of this thing. This thing would cost me friendships and relationships. So I need to deal with myself, brutally so. I need to punish myself for, why do I have this thing? Why am I making other people feel so uncomfortable? And then I grew out of primary into high school. And the thing about stigma is that really, like I said, it's a people thing. It's a what you've heard about a thing and how connected you are to the conversation and to the person. And I share no resentment for my primary school friends. I knew nothing. They knew nothing. They could have not helped me. I did not have answers for them. So when I came to high school, I made new friends, told them my story, and they accepted me. And it was so beautiful. And I realized the importance of giving time to time. And I understand that the HIV conversation comes with understanding. It comes with knowledge. If you're unknowledgeable, you isolate yourself from people. You stigmatize them. You treat them horribly, not because you want to, but because you don't know. You're not empowered with information as to how to navigate this. My friends in high school knew about this. They had their own personal connections to HIV with, you know, but they knew. They were knowledgeable. So when they when they heard my story, they handled me with care. They handled me with understanding that, no man, this thing you can... I think when I heard about being undetectable for the first time, it was through my best friend, was like, you know, now that people can get to a point where they can't transmit the virus, I was like, you're lying. and that's the thing really with stigma. So it needs to start, the acceptance, the journey needs to start from internal. You need to defeat the beast within so that the people outside can really see that, you know, if she's living so bold, what can I really do to bring her down? I mean, people still try. I mean, I create content about living with HIV. I connect with a remarkable audience of people who are living with HIV and who are not, and are just navigating the two-part story. And then there's an audience that is still unknowledgeable or rather stubborn about being sensitive to the HIV conversation. And I really don't care what you say to me, but I think what you say to me is some sort of working data for me, because I want to understand the core of why you think that's going to hurt me. Where is that coming from in your personal life? What has happened to you that you'd say that to me? And using all those negative comments as well, I use them to navigate and help other people so that we know when we are in rooms and advocating for AGYWs and talking about stigma, what we're actually talking about. Because stigma is not just one thing anymore. Stigma is a big thing. Yes, we've come a very long way from what and how stigma was when stigma was, you know, stigma on HIV was referred to as a death sentence. As to how stigma now looks like with the US aid funding cuts, there's a great transformative when it comes to stigma there. And we need to inform people if we want stigma to stop. It starts with people and it ends with people.
All right. You know, I think everyone can have a say in the transformation part, because I did say, Tina, you should also let me know, how do we now transform the public narrative, especially in 2025? There are still people who are ignorant, as Ibanomonde has said, that even in creating the content, there's an audience who still is stubborn and still wants to have this stigma that is proven, it's false. So how do we now get to the stubborn people?
Well, I would say that I used to be one of those people who didn't know much about HIV until recently. My diagnosis was 5 months ago. Yeah. So I had to try and find information related to stigma, because then it came to a point where I had a partner. Then I disclosed that I have this thing. Yeah. I have HIV. And then He was taken aback. He said, I have a son I need to take care of. I can't die now. I got confused as to what exactly did he mean by he can't die now. And then with the whole stigma thing, it led me back to when I was doing research, because I was new to this whole experience. There was a something I saw that said we need to go back to the beginning of stigma, where people, when there was in the beginning in 1990, in those years in the 90s, yeah, where people where when someone had HIV, they'd show that somebody who's sick, somebody who's thin, somebody who's already dying. But then they never really showed that, they never knew information, Uguti, it would take about 10 years for you to actually develop into that stage. That stage would probably be AIDS. So they never knew the history of how long, I'd say maybe Pumzi, how long Pumzi has had HIV. But then they'd only know when Pumzi is sick now, when Pumzi goes to the clinic and says, I'm sick, I wonder what's wrong with me. So that then that's how the stigma started. It started with people seeing people falling, dying. Then if someone has HIV, they'd know that, okay, in 2 years' time, this person is going to die, but they do not know the history of how long this person has been diagnosed with HIV. So with stigma, I'm still new to the whole stigma scenario, yeah. But I do realize that I do have internal stigma as well. But I haven't really known how to exactly to describe the emotions, because sometimes it feels like shame. I'd be angry at a partner I had, and then they reacted the way that they did, but they not say, but I do not deserve to be angry at this person because I'm living with this virus. So even I as a person, me, who was aware of HIV, who accepted the status, I do suffer with internal stigma, and sometimes I do not know how to overcome it. But then because I have such a positive background, I have such a positive family, when I disclosed it, my mother is a nurse, so she deals with those scenarios all the time. So she just sat me down and I told her, she's in Eastern Cape though, so she did it over the phone. So I was telling her, she was at work, I was crying. And then she comforted me through the phone. She said, okay, give me a minute, Sissy. I'll come to you. I'll call you when I'm in a quiet place. I told her that I've been diagnosed with HIV and I do not know how, because I contacted the partner I had and he went to go get a test and his is negative. And I contacted my ex and his is negative as well. My ex, I had been with my ex we broke up 3 years ago. Yeah. So then I had to search the person I was with 3 years ago, and his was also negative. So I was like, Mama, I don't understand. And she said, you will never know how you got it, and it's fine. Maybe somebody lied, maybe one of your partners lied, or it could have been one of those accidents where you got in contact with bodily fluids and you happened to have it. So it was one of those scenarios with me that I'm still trying to overcome, and I'm still trying to learn through the whole process of stigma. Mm-hmm. So I don't really have much information about stigma, but I can say that whenever I hear people having bad information about HIV, it scares me. It scares me a lot because I'm like, okay, I still have a whole future ahead of me where now I have to disclose these details to people, and I always worry how they'll react to me. Yeah. But so far with the people I've had, everything goes well. But I do not know about the future of how I'll be able to handle stigma. So I'd say stigma is important for us as human beings to talk about, families in their households to talk about HIV, mothers mostly, because that's their role as a family. So they'd tell their children about HIV. So it all comes to the head of the households. Because stigma, HIV should just be talked about in general, because yeah. It can happen to anyone. It doesn't say because you're promiscuous, you will have HIV. No, we do not know that. So everybody should be talking about HIV in order to end the stigma.
All right. Iba Nomond, I'm going to come back to you. I know I'm diverting a little bit from the brief. But for someone who's, lived with it long, how do you talk to your fellow sister who has just found out? She just said, I'm new to this. I don't know how to navigate the stigma. I don't know how to handle the criticism, how I stigmatize my own self, how internal it gets. What would you share? What would you say to Utina?
So I was just saying that it's important to sit with your pain. I did that for the longest time. And as much as I'm saying, learn and inform yourself, because that kind of helps with, fighting the misconceptions when you have the scientific proof, the scientific backing to the insecurities. Like if you say you're going to die and then science says, no, but if you're taking your treatment well, then you're undetectable. No, you're not going to die. You're going to die if you default and you don't take your treatment, blah, 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 blah. But sometimes you just have to sit with your pain, you know. There's no amount of information that can overcome what sitting with it can do. And I did that for the longest time. And when I say that I come from, like at home, my grandma was also a nurse. My uncle studied something in health. So at that time, he was still like a scholar though. So he was doing the HIV and AIDS kind of module or whatever. But so he would also come with, you know, technical biomedical answers instead of all of them doing a heart to heart. And that did not work. What I just needed was like to demonstrate my vulnerability and someone to just take it. Even to myself, I just needed to be vulnerable and not have it all figured out and not have answers and have answers, but don't listen to them because it's not a rational experience. It's not linear. So it's very messy. But it's okay to acknowledge that, you know, you're dealing with it. And when you don't know, you don't know. But also just involve people, your heart people, and tell them things. And not everyone deserves your vulnerability because, you know, people can be unsafe and you don't want someone taking you back on the progress that you've developed with yourself. But I think essentially I always just tell people to sit with the pain. And my favorite one is to do the things that you love. So whether it's painting, writing, cooking, baking, do all those things, because those are all the things that make you see that HIV does not really have power. Because if it did have so much power, then it would paralyze you from doing all those things. But you can still do them. So, yeah.
Thank you for that.
Those are really comforting words.
Very comforting. Mm-hmm. So there has been the recent shifts in USAID, and PEPFAR funding, and they've raised so much concerns, as Usista did mention before, about the sustainability of HIV programs, especially in Africa. This does happen to be the poorest continent in the world. What would an African-led community-anchored HIV response look like, and how can we build it in the face of global donor fatigue? I think I'll hand this one to you, Amanda.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, we can't deny the fact that PEPFAR and USAID funding has saved, you know, millions of lives, and they've built health infrastructure that has seen the outcomes that we are currently seeing now. But I really believe that it's about time Africa shifts from donor dependency to resilience. It's about time when we are talking about sustainability and looking to the future to look at how do we get community-led programs that are led, but not only led, designed by the communities, monitored by the communities, and feed into the whole structure of the HIV program. We need to look at how are our youth in the communities going to drive what they own. We've got communities such as your key populations. How are they going to be able to drive what they own as well? But I think most importantly, taking advantage of the south-to-south collaborations, what is it that Africa as a continent can do without us then working in silos in terms of South Africa saying, PEPFAR funding has been cut. What is South Africa going to do? We've got institutions like your CDC Africa that has been established in the past few years and are able to collaborate with the different countries within the African continent to drive funding, to drive collaboration among the different countries within Africa. But I think what is important is for us to look into the communities who are really struggling with the pandemic, if we are going to, and these are the youths and this is the key population. But coming up also with innovations, data-driven innovations that are going to be catalytic, so to say, into finding solutions. It's not only about us testing now. It's about getting to that last destination, and that is to end AIDS, to live in an AIDS-free world. And with Africa being the continent with the highest burden, I think the AIDS-led programs need to be owned by Africa and not have the dependency on funding from the West. So, yeah, there's a lot that can be done.
Yeah. And I hear you so much when you speak of, you know, it needs to start within Africa. What do we do? What does South Africa do? Because there was a bit of a panic, you know, in the beginning of the year, if you remember. There had to be ministers chipping in and saying, oh, no, well, it's not what you think it is. It's not as deep as you think it is. But in a way, you could say that it is deep because it is coming from the West. What do we have internally as Africans, as South Africans? Now, I want to shift the dynamic. I want us to talk about being navigating a relationship, romantic relationship. So it's very difficult, especially for many HIV individuals who are born with the virus, to navigate relationship. And it involves a lot of layers of disclosure, fear, as well as rejection, right? What support systems do you need in normalizing the conversation between you and your partner? How do you start with that? Yeah, I'll pose the question to everyone, actually, anyone who wants to, you know, answer the question. I think I'll start with you, Ibanamonde.
Okay, thank you. I just quickly want to reflect on what Sis Amanda was saying. I also think that it's important for the private sector to also be involved in making sure that the HIV response in Africa is sustained. Yes, there's a lot of progress that's been made, and external donors and partnerships are important, but it needs to come from home. 8 million people living with HIV in South Africa now, I think. And you can't tell me that those 8 million people are not investing in your business. So we need the private sector to give back to the people that are investing in their businesses as well. In terms of navigating romantic relationships, well, there's no training really, you know. No one teaches us these things. You just have to stumble through it and mess up and be messed up and then deal with the heartbreak. But I think for me, when I started navigating, this was in high school, I didn't know what to say, what to do, but I just knew that I was allowed to not tell anyone until just a random encounter where this person asked me, are you living with HIV? Which is so random when I look at the pattern of things, because the day before I told my teacher and we heard like a noise, and then somehow now you're asking me this, what happened? And I said to him, no, I'm not. Mind you, I'm panicking in my head because this has never been part of the scenarios I made, because I plan things in my head. Okay, this is how I'm going to tell my friends. Okay, this is okay. When I'm 35, okay. And all of a sudden, the time frame is not making sense. You're asking me too early. And I went to write my exam. It was Afrikaans. I don't know what I wrote in that paper, because the entire time what I was thinking of is, this is not how I'm going to lead my story. So I need to go back to that person and tell them that, yes, I'm living with HIV. I'm not going to lie about my status, but I will not deserve you my vulnerability if I'm not ready for it. Yeah. But if you've asked me, I won't lie about it. So I went back to him and I told him that, hey, man, yeah, actually, I am living with HIV. And the only thing I had was a, yes, I am living with HIV. I didn't have any other thing to help you with that. So then that ended there. For some time, I was upset with him. And what made situations worse was, I think, a couple of weeks after, in the LO class, we covered HIV. Yeah. For the longest time, I was in LO class. The HIV topic was going on, but it was just me. Now, in 1 year, I'm having the HIV. They're covering the HIV curriculum. My friends know, which, yes, yes, nice. This is comforting. But this person also, who knows about my status and is scared of me, is also in the same class. So there was that existentialism dynamic in the class. How do I even go to class? It was just so difficult. Especially when I was listening in the entire teaching, there was nothing that was going to make him feel better in that. So for the longest time, I felt shameful because of the rejection. I felt like it was defining me. You rejected me because I'm some unsafe element walking around in the earth. And then I got angry at some point. But the funny thing is that after high school, I realized that I had nothing to offer him. And he had nothing to offer me in return. So even if he wanted to do the experience with me, even if he wanted to continue being with me and had questions, I wouldn't know how to answer him. So it was somewhat better that way. But with rejection in relationships, because that does happen, it's a thing. We can't just, it's a thing. Rejection in relationships happen when it comes to HIV. But it's not your fault. It's because the other person just can't do it. And when someone can't do something, it's not because of you. It's because they cannot. And unfortunately, we sometimes make it up at ourselves. I don't know how we can detach from making it ourselves and blaming ourselves. But it's not about us. It's really not personal. Someone has to go through that, and you also have to go through that. They need to go through the learning experience. We can't teach our lovers all the time. They need to have the responsibility of learning to love us too, you know, and holding safe spaces for us. So another shift side of that would look like, I tell my partner that I'm living with HIV, and then he's like, okay, but how do I support you? Because now I realize that what I just knew, now there's like another different element to who you are. So how do I support you? When do you collect your treatment? Do I drive you there? What do you want to have after ice cream? What do you do when it's cold and the water's super cold and you have to drink your pills? Do I warm your water up for you? Those sort of love languages, you know, help. I think you just have to be born with some sort of sensitivity. Yeah. We can't teach people everything. I don't know if I'm just like, but that. And I think for me, though, my status is like everywhere. You cannot bother me. You cannot bother me if you don't want to be bothered by this. Like, if it's something you can't do, don't reach out to me. So I don't really go through the pain of disclosure like that, because it's just out there. But when I was doing disclosure, my golden rule was to deserve people your vulnerability. Just because you're with someone for 500 years does not mean they deserve your vulnerability. And I always tell people, the way you talk about HIV in the presence of whom you do not know their status is important, because you might be thinking you're shaming Iba Nomonde just by seeing her TikTok. But your friend is living with HIV and they want to tell you. They can't tell you anymore because you can't be trusted. This is how you speak about it. And then you come to my DMs and you're like, oh, I found my friend's pill, but she doesn't tell me. It's because of how you talk about it, about other people. It's the same sensitivity. You need to be sensitive to other people so that the people in your life can be comfortable with disclosing their vulnerability to you, because they can trust you. If you're untrustworthy, let's not do vulnerability to people who don't deserve it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tina, do you have something to say? Like, how is it navigating, you know, through romantic relationships? How do you normalize the sex topic? We're talking about intimacy, sex. There's so much to it.
Interestingly enough, I have had encounters where I had to tell somebody who was pursuing me romantically that I actually am living with HIV, and I'd be surprised when they react to it positively. I'm like, oh, I wasn't expecting that reaction. I thought maybe you'd glitch for some reason. And then they'd say, no, okay, I understand. When there's something called U equals U, meaning that you can't give it to me and it's undetectable on your side. So they said, then that will be okay. And then I'd have somebody asking me, then if you have HIV, then how are we going to have kids? Talks like that. And then I'll tell them that there's actually preventive measures where mothers can prevent their child from having HIV, and it's my responsibility as your partner to make sure that I do not transmit the virus to you, because I want to take care of you and I also want to take care of myself. Yeah. So I give such explanations. It's more like an education topic if the person is interested to learn more. So I'm always eager if somebody
pursues me romantically. I do actually have to see, though, is it worthy for me to be telling the person that, hey, I'm living with this? I need to check, are they emotionally intelligent enough for me to be able to be vulnerable with them like that? So I just, there's people worth telling and there's people not worth telling, meaning then that I wouldn't mind if this person rejects me because of my truth. But this other person, I would be like, I will not tell you, meaning that I will just say I'm not interested. So you just need to calculate your risk, because there's always risk. There's pros and cons to telling people. And because you're living with HIV, you need to learn as a person to accept that not everybody will want to. It's more of a, do you consent? So there's consent in this world. So if they do not want to consent to this life, then it is okay. You need to understand that. That's the reality of living with HIV, yes.
And I just want to add on the, and I'm glad that Tina touched on the U equals U message, because, you know, from us who are running the HIV program, it is about that, right? We are at that stage where we are saying this is not just a slogan, it's a fact. It's a scientific fact. It gives people living with HIV the tools, but also it gives people who are living with HIV the opportunity to actually live that life romantically within their families and the society in which they engage in, and be bold in saying it is a scientific fact that is proven that, you know, undetectable is equals to untransmissible. If my viral load is undetectable, I will not be able to transmit the disease to you. And therefore, you and I can build a family. We could have children. So questions that are being asked around, oh, but then if we do date, if I want a child, how are we going to have a child? I think we've made scientific strides, but also in a social and humane environment when it comes to the U equals U slogan or concept. I'd like to say to people, it mustn't just be a slogan. It really has to be a known fact. And people, especially healthcare workers who are in our communities and our facilities, needs to preach the language.
All right. We're at the end. Before I do let you go, I think I'll pose the question to anyone who feels like answering. Have we at least educated enough about HIV? Are people more knowledgeable about the virus, and are they more responsive to society, social things, people that are living with HIV? Like, are we at a better place?
I think maybe Sister can answer that from what she sees, especially from the youth that she services when they do come into the clinic. What would you say are the messages and the questions? And then we can then expand on that.
Okay, with the experience that I have, we still have a problem with challenge with the youth. There are those that are still scared of, you know, getting tested. You find that someone never get tested for HIV since that person is born. And then when you try to advise, it's like you are telling that person something that's so, yes, it's so scary to some other people. I think we still have a lot of work to do in terms of advising them to go for testing, because they are engaging in unprotected sex. They are not yet knowing their statuses. So it means that we need to get the youth, even the peers. We have recruited a lot of peers, at least to educate them so that they can even educate others. And also to let them know the programs that we have, that, you know, if it's not the end of the world. So we do have the PrEP. So where you can, you know, use the PrEP and you are safe. So we need young people to come forth and help us with regards to giving the information to others. So it's still a challenge, but we can do more better than that.
And that's a wrap of episode 2, Still Me, Living Positive with HIV. A very big thank you to our guests, Amanda Mohlala, Ibanomonde Ngema, Sister Zivu, and Tina Jam, from your host, Pumelele Wakazulu.